Welcome back to Light on Conspiracies, the second part for subscribers only.
I'm here with my new friend, Zuzi Mazzoli, and we were talking about fear and why it's so important. It's so important for us to be able to let go of it, or at least try and learn how to become less and less fearful. Because in my opinion, after many years of being afraid, is that as soon as you let fear in, that is when you can be controlled. And they don't even have to control you. You are controlling yourself just by the fear of it all. And fear and doubt, these are the two traitors for me. If I let doubt come in, I know it will just mess me up. So I try to stay way clear of these two. But I thought it was very interesting that you were talking about being able to see fear. Because, I mean, you can see a dog can smell it, but also they see it right away. If you're fearful, and a lot of predators and so on will see it right away, they can spot you a mile away.
Yeah.
But in what way do you mean that you can see it? Is it visual or?
Sometimes it's actually visual. It's like a shimmering, and but it's more like an overlay of knowing on top of something. So it's like a seeing with your mind rather than a seeing with your eyes. I know that sounds kind of weird, but it's like more of a knowing in a way. But also sometimes it's very visual. So for me, I work as an energetic healer, and I'll look at somebody, and if I don't see them in focus, I know that they're sick. So people that are very sick, yes. So I see people that have stage 4 cancer that they're very, very sick, and they'll kind of be literally blurry energetically. Visually, I'm looking at like the outline of their body, and it's like a blur, and I can't, it's like I need to put my glasses on to see them properly, like that. But then people that are really healthy, they have clarity and they're acute. So that's my own personal experience that I've had, but I can see it too with animals, with plants, with sometimes even just in a room, in a situation. Yeah.
I must say, I'm very happy you don't use glasses when we talk. that would make me somewhat concerned. But
well,
would you mind? Would you mind if we go back a little more about your experiences in Sarajevo and
sure.
And the people you met there, and how what I found when I was in Iran during the war was like how people are in these situations, because it's so easy to hide if everything is fine, if you're comfortable and warm and so on, and you've got food, not a problem. But once you start getting hungry and cold and so on, then the real you step forward many times, and it's not very pretty. At the same time, it's in these situations where you can see real beauty as well. And I was thinking if you have any memories you want to share, or the way you, how long were you there?
It was wow. So much has happened in my life. I mean, so much has happened in the last 52 years that I actually struggle sometimes to remember things. So it was weeks. I can't remember exactly how long, but whether it was 6 weeks, I'm not sure.
It's a long time.
But the war had been going on already for like some time, like maybe it was the second year. So just to sort of, what happened was I was traveling every week or every 2 weeks to two or three different countries, to Australia, to Brazil, to South Africa, all over Europe. So for me, and then I've done so much work since then with timelines and I've done experiments with the Montauk people. So I found that my ability to remember exact timing on some things is very difficult. Maybe because I'm going through all these different timelines, I'm not sure. But what I do remember very clearly is that the people were already, what I would say, they had become accustomed to that environment. So for them, it was normal. It was already quite normal. And I quickly adapted to that normal as well. So I was giving a lecture about contemporary art. One of the things was just to keep doing things like normal. So at the art school, I gave a lecture about my travels and about contemporary art from the region and what I had been seeing. I actually brought some slides with me. And I remember standing outside and talking with someone, and I got shot at, and I remember just seeing a bullet, and it was just like here, it landed right behind me, like just about here. And the person grabbed me and pulled me down and pulled me through the door. And I remember recovering from it very quickly and thinking, wow, that's how we adapt. Like, we can adapt to these situations so quickly. Like, you know, if that happened to me now, I'd be freaked out. But I wasn't freaked out, and I adapted. And so there's, I think that's also so interesting, is how we adapt and become, these unnormal things becomes, we're able to live in those environments.
But don't you find it scary as well, because cruelty can come in there as well, that cruelty can become normal?
I think cruelty, so now coming into like my spiritual understanding now, I think that cruelty, and this is going to sound probably quite strange, but I think cruelty is not a part of a human being. I think that that's almost like an overlay on top of us. I think essentially human beings are loving and collaborative and compassionate, and I think that this overlay of aggression and violence and competition and greed, I don't believe that that's actually a part of us really. I think it's somehow, and this sounds so naive.
To me, it
seems to be this overlay on our matrix, on our conscious world, on whatever you want to call it.
Do you know, I remember I was on a bus in Iran, and there was there were all of these roadblocks, you know, and they stopped and they just pulled people off, threw them on some trucks and drove off. And there was this soldier that came up to me. I looked him in the eyes. I tell you, it really freaked me out. Not that he did anything violent or anything like that, but looking in his eyes, they were dead. There was nothing there. And they were in a way that I knew that this person could slaughter anyone with no emotion. There was, and what I felt was, it was not evil. It was the lack of light. There was no light. It was turned off somehow.
Why do you think it would turn off, though?
He was damaged, you know, in, I'm sure. Oh. And I spoke to Chip Tatum, a CIA whistleblower who used to be an assassin for George Bush Sr. We'd become friends, which is...
Great to be in the friends company here.
Yeah, but it is a strange thing for me to say. I've never met him in person, but I've got my website on his server, and we sort of, he invited me many times on his show, and I invited him, and so on. And I deeply respect what he's doing now, trying to do everything to redeem himself and also to help save us all. At the same time, there's no way that I can accept what he's been doing, because he's done horrific stuff and very cruel stuff, and as cruel as they get.
Was he mind controlled? Was he a Manchurian candidate?
I don't think so. I have no idea. I know that he was recruited as he was 19. And I mean, he signed up for the military because he heard there were some good surfing waves in Vietnam. You know, totally. He came from Florida and it just was cool with a uniform and so on. So he signed up, and he was just supposed to be some kind of radio operator, or actually he had no idea, but one of the ones that were out in the middle of enemy lines on your own, there to report sort of where the shooting was going on or where they were hitting. And so that was his task. But also what he found out then was that his position, having knowledge about their own positions and maps and everything, as soon he was always accompanied by someone, and that other person's job was to kill him if something happened. But he had no idea to start with. But then he got involved. Somebody got hurt in a parachute jump, and they just said, "Okay, you, Tatum, come over and join." And he had no idea, but what they were being sent on a false flag operation where they blew up the. It was not the airport in Saigon. It was somewhere like that, blaming it on the Vietnamese, Viet Cong, but it was actually the Americans doing it. So they left bodies of Vietnamese and Viet Cong soldiers, but the Americans also wanted to make sure that nobody would ever talk about it. So they were going to eliminate Chip and the other ones as well. And he had no idea. He was 19, totally naive, no idea. And then they were driving down in a truck down the road. He was still shaky from this whole thing. It was the first time he saw people getting killed. And I mean, they killed these soldiers, the Viet Cong ones, just to leave evidence. And suddenly his officer just pulled a machine gun and killed the other people in the truck. Because he knew that they were going to be taken out. He felt it, you know. And so it's a long story, but they had to go through, get back through enemy lines. And out of 13, there were only two left in the end. And there were some, Chip got wounded and in a coma. And when he woke up, William Colby, the future CIA director, who was then known as the ambassador, was sitting by his bed and saying, "Listen, son, I'm really sorry to tell you, but you know too much. You know, you are in a position where you were not meant to be here, but you know too much. So you got an option. We kill you or you work for us. Choose." So he chose to life, and that got him in to the CIA, where he was very tightly held for years. And then he sort of started getting up in the ranks, became an excellent, superb pilot. He can fly anything. And I don't know why we got into this. Yes, one time I asked him, because this is a man who's been surrounded by assassins, soldier of fortunes, you know, like mercenaries, his whole life. So I asked him, since he'd been working with all the presidents on a personal level from Nixon and upward. But George Bush is the one that I find, if I've ever seen a human monster, he would be it. But he sounds so nice and he looks nice. And so it's always been sort of like a mystery. I've never been able to figure it out. That's also why it's so interesting for me to hear about George Soros. And so I asked Chip, I said, "When you look in his eyes, what is your feeling?" And he said that George Bush Sr. was by far the most intelligent person he ever met, and also by far the most evil. And Chip also told me about, he has some nightmares, and he said there are, when it comes to the world of assassins, there are like three groups. Young ones that have no idea that they think they're doing it for their country and liberty, you know, they, after a month or so, they would totally understand that they've been duped, you know, that they are there to kill for somebody else's greed. Then there were group number two were people that knew it was wrong what they were doing, but did it for the money, you know. Assassins, this is my trade. I kill people, you pay me. And then Chip said, then there are the dead eyes. And he said, these are damaged individuals. I mean, he didn't even call them individuals. He called them like killing machines, more or less. He says, they have no mercy. They have nothing there. And I believe that was such an individual that I met there in Iran. And Chip said that his nightmare is that sometimes he wakes up and he is he says, I'm sleeping, but I'm awake, you know, and he's lying on his back and he has one of these dead eyes hovering right on top of him. So he can feel him breathing on him and he can't move. He can't do anything. That is one scary nightmare. Oh, God.
Well, maybe it's not a nightmare.
I know, but that just makes it five times worse, you know.
So during the last few years, I've been organizing conferences in New York, and I have no doubt that the technology exists for soldiers to be super soldiers or to be altered or mentoring candidates or the technology to implant the mind or all of it. I keep an open mind and do lots of research and stay very alert to the fact that the technology is far, far, far more evolved than what we think exists. Even the unclassified DARPA documents from several years ago are talking about the spraying of certain hormones up the nose, certain chemicals like oxytocin, that would make a soldier feel that they are doing the right thing, the just thing, the moral thing. One of the people that came out at the conference last time to the public for the first time, Sergeant Dan McBolan, was a Manchurian candidate and spoke very clearly about his work in the military and literally doing things in his ultra personality, killing people.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to interview Chip in this series of podcasts. He's already accepted. So I'm going to ask him, because I've never even thought about him possibly being a Manchurian candidate or MK Ultra or whatever. I've always had the impression that he was sharp and just doing. I mean, the thing was he was forced into it to start with. And then I think he got carried away, you know, with power, with medals, with, I mean, he always had between $25,000 and $250,000 in his pocket when they were out on operations and so on. You know, it's like, I heard an interview with one of the people involved in the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme. It was a South African agent who was in one of these death squads. And he said, we were living in the heart of the whore. You know, I've never really been able to understand what he meant by that, but I think he meant totally corrupt. You know, that they were so, they were so intoxicated by power. That they, you know, the feeling that they could just kill anyone, you know, they could just that they were invincible, and mm-hmm. I think it's the same with Chip also. That is just my personal.
I mean, my sense is that he's being manipulated a lot.
I hope so.
Yeah. There was something. I've met so many very strange and interesting people throughout my work. Including like Jimmy Carter, the Queen of England. I spent 15 minutes with her in Australia, which was very strange. And I do know what you mean by that, that I think it is the gaze. Like, you know, you can really fall into someone's eyes and feel the compassion and the humanity, or you can be repelled in some way. And I had a very interesting experience when I moved to America. My husband, who died of cancer, sadly, was American. And we moved to America. And on the day that we moved, we arrived at JFK Airport. And we were going through customs. And because I was emigrating, I had to be separated from him. And I was taken to this room. And there I met my first, like, publicly announced MI6 agent. And it was, what's his name? Richard Tomlinson, the famous MI6 agent.
Sounds very interesting.
So I'm saying this because of this the training that people receive and how far the training goes. But I was emigrating with two dogs and my husband, and, you know, moving to New York, and I was sitting in the chair in the immigration room, and this kind of James Bond handsome, you know, a man starts talking to me and says, hey, could you help me? Could you get a message out to the people outside? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know, whatever, you know. Miss Naivete. And he said, I'm supposed to give an interview on CBS or one of the news stations in New York. I'm supposed to give an interview, and could you just please tell them that I'm not coming out, that I'm being deported back to Switzerland? And I was like, yeah, sure. He said, tell them my name and tell them I'm not coming out. And I was like, okay. And then he started to tell me I was just being very quiet. And he said, you know, I'm supposed to go on TV because I used to be a spy with the MI6, with the Foreign Service, and from England. And I know that they killed Princess Diana. So I just sat there thinking, oh my God. Like, really? Like, here I am. I'm just emigrating to America. I'm just trying to, like, do the right thing. And already I have a spy telling me about the death of Princess Diana. You know, just like this always being in these situations, crazy situations. And so the immigration officer, this great big cop, came over to me and he said, lady, don't say a word. And I was like, okay. And, you know, totally quiet. And this guy's just... And he's telling me the whole story of how he was trained in the service, and this particular assignment, the process they were going to use was that what they were going to use to kill Saddam Hussein, like the tunnel and the motorbikes and stuff. And I was just thinking, oh my gosh, could I just please get out of immigration? Like, I don't want to hear this. And he kept telling me exactly how it was planned, and that he didn't want to do it, and that he was called to do it with Princess Diana, and that he refused to do it, that he believed that she was a good person, that he refused to do it. And then they locked him up, and he was in confinement or something, and he was now in Switzerland, and he was coming forth, and he was a whistleblower. And then finally the policeman came over and literally picked me up and moved me over and sat me beside two men that were handcuffed to the chairs. And then they took him into a room and he disappeared and I never saw him again. And I remember coming out at JFK and saying to my husband, oh, I need to go and tell the, and he said, Susie, no way. Just keep walking, lady. Just keep walking. And, I remember just after he died, maybe a year later, in the supermarket, seeing it on one of those tabloid newspapers, a photograph of him and the story, the whole story. And I remember thinking, wow, that's crazy, like crazy. And that's when I really started looking more and more into what's going on and how things are going on. But I think it's in the eyes. It's so much about looking at people.
Do you know, David Icke mentioned once that he was at the cinema and there were like two rows that were totally empty, so he thought, oh, that's handy. So he was on his own. He just went and sat down. And the reason why these two rows were empty was because they were reserved for Jimmy Carter. So Jimmy Carter and his bodyguards came and sat down right next to David Icke. And David Icke said, what are the chances? What are the chances? So they said hello and so on. And afterwards, Icke said that it was like sitting with an empty body. There was no one there. That was his experience, that there was. So what was your experience meeting him? And the Queen, I'm really interested in how it was to meet the Queen as well.
So I think this is back when I wasn't as in tune or aligned as I am now. Now I probably would see so much more and feel so much more. But I remember standing with the Queen and that it was like opening a refrigerator door and standing in front of the refrigerator. It was cold. Like there was like this, oh, I even get goosebumps. There was like this cold energy. And of course you're not really supposed to look at her and you're not really supposed to engage with her. And I mean, she had that incredibly white skin and her voice was very, very strange, but it was the temperature that I noticed so distinctly. that just standing next to her, there was like this literally temperature change. With Jimmy Carter, I was in a very large group of people and I shook his hand, and I don't remember so much of him. I just remember that big smile, but I don't remember so much of him. But I have had a lot of other experiences with what I would call multidimensionals or shapeshifters, or, you know, let's go far and say reptilians, or people that have been replaced. And I have definitely had encounters with people that, what I call them, are empty cereal boxes, that there is a physical being, but there's no humanity, no consciousness. And I can see that in two different ways. One would be that they are replaced, literally. I mean, I believe that the technology exists, that people can be literally replicated or cloned or 3D printed, and consciousness can be put inside them. To me, there's no question that we have, or not we, that there are other civilizations or beings here that have other technologies that are way beyond. And that's so much of the work we're doing, is researching that. And I've had my own personal experience of being in physical contact with something that was not human.
How was Jimmy Carter's handshake? Dead fish.
Yeah, you know, it's so long ago that it doesn't register so much. It's perhaps more interesting the type of people that you meet going around the conferences now.
Yeah.
that have questionable handshakes. But I think that's our job, is to be more discerning now.
Mm. So the Queen, did you shake hands with her? Or?
No. Oh, no, not a touch her. No. There was a whole long process of teaching you how to look, how to not look, how to curtsy. Like, I spent like half an hour learning how to curtsy, the right type of curtsy. And it was very interesting because, and this is how, like, I'm always kind of fascinated about these situations that I find myself in, or get myself into, of course, is that this was the first exhibition of contemporary art that she had ever been to in her life, apparently, according to the Queen's staff. And it was a really, really big deal. So it was the opening of a big art centre in Adelaide, South Africa, with a concert hall, an art gallery, you know, a big, big new art centre. And the Premier of South Australia was there, and he was walking around with the Queen. And it just happened that the gallery was hosting an exhibition of contemporary Hungarian art that I was touring around Australia. And the first stop was in Adelaide. And so that's how she and I crossed paths. I do believe that she has a different energy to other human beings.
Mm.
Yeah.
This whole thing with reptilians and shapeshifters, I've stayed away from that very on purpose, because I saw what happened to David Icke when he started talking about these things, that people just shut down, or that they, you know, it's like that you lose total credibility. And I felt on an early stage that if I'm here to make a difference, I need to be razor sharp in one area and stay there, not spread all over the place, and avoid aliens, reptilians, and
good luck.
No, I'm not. I'm avoiding talking about them.
Right.
So, with Ike, I have no idea. I have no personal experience, whatever, when it comes to reptilians and so on. But I mean, so much else that he's been talking about has been super spot on, and so on. So in these areas, I have no idea. I stay away. Once we transcended this whole thing, I'm going to look more into it, or when I've got some more time. And but you say that you've had personal experiences with it, with these type of things.
Yes, I have. I've had personal experiences which are probably a lot in those realms that you don't want to go into.
Oh, that's right.
But to me, I'm almost the opposite in that I can't be razor sharp in just one area. So I am an expert in nothing. I'm inquisitive about absolutely everything. And to me, if anything, it's putting all of these pieces together, you know, like this great big holographic jigsaw puzzle, and behind all of it, to me, is the question of spirituality, the meaning, the experience, the consciousness. So there's no way that I could restrict myself to one area, because there is not one area. There's all of this going on. And from my childhood, my interest in all things spiritual throughout all of these years and explorations of Tibetan Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, and, you know, all the dogmatic religions. And then, you know, I traveled to Peru and South America and work with the shamans and drink ayahuasca, you know, so it's all about expanding our consciousness and then putting it together and finding what's the meaning. And I keep finding every time I'm working with Native Americans, or I'm working in Africa or in South America, so many of our histories, our cultural systems go back to a star people. And whenever I have my own visions and my own experiences, I'm always encountering also star people. And at a very, very young age, I began channeling. And channeling to me is basically translating information that I'm receiving from, not from this realm, it's definitely from a realm that is what I would call of a more expansive experience. And that information that's been coming in is saying that there is now happening on this planet a great separation, a separation between what we would call torturing pain and suffering and a place of freedom and liberation. And when I follow your work and I follow the black and white, or the you know, the practical information, people on the street and what's literally happening, and I go further behind that to find the people that are planning that, the money, where it's coming from. And if you just keep going up and up and up and up, which I know you do, but you stop at a certain level. And then I know there are many people that keep going up those steps to find what is the agenda and where is it really coming from. Is quite often we find ourselves in a non-human realm. Mm-hmm. And that non-human realm goes both ways. Obviously, it can be benevolent and not benevolent. And so of course there are many, many people doing research, like, you know, like Kerry Cassidy and so many great people that we follow, that we listen to. And in my work, what I've been doing is just listening to all of it, trying to put anything that I can together, sussing out what's disinformation, what's real information, even interviewing people that I think are also perhaps providing disinformation, and presenting it hopefully as neutrally as possible to the people that will listen. And the people, what I'm finding is that it's very difficult to try and unravel all of this information without going to a non-human plane. And I just recently, I was very lucky to go to Switzerland to visit Billy Meyer. Do you know him at all?
I recognize the name, but I don't know him.
So he's someone that claims to be a contactee, and that the Pleiadians and people from an alternate universe came to him and said, you know, the people of Earth need to listen to this because they're about to blow themselves up. So could you please take photographs of our ships, tell the people of the world that there are other beings in this universe, not just them. And every time they do a nuclear test or blow something up, that they're actually affecting the universe, not just themselves. So it's a mission of peace. It's a mission of liberation, of love. And he's very famous for taking photographs and things. And he teaches, and he's got many books. And when I went to meet him, he said that there had been 23 attempts on his life. And so if aliens don't exist, if there's no other agenda except human, why would we even need to sort of talk about someone being killed? Like, it's why is it's, you've had attempts on your life because you're exposing an agenda. Yeah.
Not attempts, threats. Yes.
Threats.
Or things have happened that could have been attempts, but
right.
I just decided not to take it like that.
Yeah, good. So that's why I believe there really is something that's more outside of just the human political financial agenda. That's bigger.
But that is also why I work sort of on a street level to decipher the tools of someone that I have no idea who are or what it is or what, but I know the answer. I know the answer is love. And
what else could it be, right?
That's it. So that's the way I say, or I feel, I really don't need to know anything else. You know, have peace as the ultimate goal, follow love, and just go through this haze of information and just, there's so much of information from all kinds of direction. I just get confused. So I just felt for my own peace of mind, I want it as quiet as possible in here. So I'm going to simplify it and love or not love, you know.
Right. And I have to say with about the love, so my work, I started this thing called the Love Now Movement, right? And that's where we do our interviews from and the conferences, and it's love now, like that's all there is. And it's about being present, being contained in the moment. And also there's no religion, there's no dogma, because I believe that we have been so manipulated to believe in something outside of ourselves, that it's all about this inside field. This, I call it the sovereign field. And that's a bottomless pit of unconditional love and compassion. And what's very interesting is the way that I actually saw this one particular reptilian being was that my heart was so full of unconditional love for this being, just love you, love you, love you, love you, love you. And it was actually the love that exposed the, what we call, you know, like the visual manipulation. So because I was so full of love, whether it's a reptilian or a good guy or a bad guy, just so full of love, so fearless, these are like my fearlessness, non-judgment and unconditional love. And if we can hold those things, then what actually happens is the guise or the manipulations or the threats, they start to dissolve, because that high frequency it can't cover anything up. So we drop into the authentic self. And so whatever we're looking at through these eyes also, because, you know, we're projecting that universe out there. So whatever we're looking at also drops its guise and drops into that authentic self, whatever it is. Mm. And then the hard thing is to not flip out when you see the truth. When you see something for what it really is, then still to hold that unconditional love, to not get afraid, to not want to like run for your life, but to still hold that. So it's like seeing the saber-toothed tiger and loving it as it is for what it is. And the same goes for the self. And I work privately with clients, you know, internationally, and I teach internationally, and that's the biggest thing for me, is always teaching, like how to love others and how also to love the self in the same way, because we have all of this layers and layers and layers of manipulation, self-manipulation, and then it's like, okay, I can love myself unconditionally, fearlessly, without judgment. And
you know,
to me, some of that agenda is about us feeling like that. Yeah.
So isn't it somehow that all of these horrible things happen there, but at the same time, they're helping us to fine-tune these things with ourselves?
I think we're doing it. I think, I mean, we're obviously we're interconnected, right? That's we know that, the plasma field, that every particle of us is also a particle of them, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a reptilian or a Illuminati or a Satanist or whatever world we want to call them, that we are together in one world and we are creating that for, I believe, our own ascension. We're all sitting in the soup together. We are the ingredients of the same soup. And the intention is for, I honestly believe, is for all of us to have the experience of what we truly are.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, so much of my work is about flipping the perspective. So taking responsibility and flipping the perspective. So when we flip that perspective, we can say, I'm making all of this happen so I can really wake up, so I can really step into my humanity, so I can be unconditionally loving no matter what's going on with everybody everywhere. And of course it's not easy, but I don't think we would choose this to be easy. I think that we're here to really deepen into our authentic self. And it's so much fun, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. No, but that's also why I don't hate, I don't feel anger or revenge or anything against the so-called them. Because I feel that the only thing that these feelings, they destroy me from the inside. They don't even know how I feel. So why let these feelings inside of me? And I also feel that if I can focus in love, you know that I'm not talking about Hollywood in love, this pink type of shimmery thing, but the power of love, the power of this incredible, the ultimate power, I would say, if I can stay in that even while being under incoming fire, or so I call it grace under pressure, mm-hmm. You know, like when, if approached by a screaming police officer or riot officer, you know, like what I've learned from a fantastic woman that I had as a spiritual teacher. Her name is Nalini Chelaram, a Raja Yoga teacher, absolutely fantastic woman, is that if somebody approaches me like that, very aggressive and so on, what I do is I turn down the volume so I don't hear it. You know, in my head, I just, and then I focus on their face. And what I do is I occupy my mind with the word divine. Just say divine, 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 because otherwise my mind can freak into fear, you know, and then I start seeing him as a monster or I, you know, and then things can happen. But if I can focus and just stay in that one, divine, divine, he's somebody's son, she's somebody's mother, you know, like, and just see them, because the eyes, when they're that angry, are so dark, and they so believe in what they're doing, and they so see me as the threat or whatever, so I don't blame them at all. But what I look is, I don't react at all, my hands are down the sides, it doesn't matter what they do, if it's weapon or sticks or whatever, and I just look for the human spark in their eyes. And when you focus on that one, then suddenly, boom, there's this, I've seen it a few times, it's like, it's fantastic, and it's very subtle, but I tell you, it's life-changing for both of us, because every time I see it, it empowers me that, yeah, this is the right way. And that person, that violent person, I believe will not be able to be violent anymore, because it just doesn't work. The spell is broken. So I find these situations extremely inspiring. And
so you say the spell is broken.
I said that. The spell of also the thing is, because they are so used to people just bending over because they've got a badge or a uniform or they've got big muscles or a big gun or whatever. The thing is, if you don't see their power, just like the bomb wouldn't see who you were in Sarajevo, it couldn't care less if you had a diploma or a business card with gold printing on it. The bomb will just hit you. And the same here, if you do not buy into the power game, they lose. They lose.
I think people need to understand how powerful they are. Like, as individuals, we're like a universe, a galaxy. We have absolutely unconditional love and unlimited amounts of power. So in connecting heart to heart and getting that love spark, it's also to remember that we are extremely powerful. And I think that's what's changing the world now, is that people are starting to recognize their own unlimited power. But we have to understand how we have sort of dampened the power. And I think that's what a lot of these spiritual techniques tend to ignore, because I'm sure you've had many spiritual conversations with people where they say, oh yes, I'm not going to concentrate on that because if I do, I'll just give it power. So a lot of people, like, I don't want to know about the false flag stuff. I don't want to give it power. I'll just concentrate on bliss and love. But I think what's enlightenment is knowledge. So I think, like, the work you're doing is so important, because what it's doing is it's giving knowledge to people. And that's what I miss. I think that as we connect heart to heart and spark the love, we also have to bring in the knowledge, the information, the truth, right? Simply, yeah.
Do you know, there was this black lady in the US who, she wrote to me, and she said that through her whole life, as a black individual, she's always known about conspiracies. She hasn't known the details, but she's already. She said, "We as a people, we've felt it our whole lives. The power of it, the suppression, the injustices. We felt it. We lived it. But listening to you, you're giving this power of face, and suddenly I can see the face and I can let go of fear, because I see how tiny it is." Even though she said she has let that belief control her life, and this is my intention. I don't give a shit about false flags, really, you know, or I couldn't care less. I mean, it's dead boring when they keep repeating, oh my God, be creative at least, do something different than Allah Akbar and that. No, but my focus is peace, and to just snap people out of and show them the recipe of this terror pie. You know, once you start seeing the ingredients, how we are being fooled, they have very, very few weapons against us, or methods of getting us into this trance. So this one, and boom, you're out. And then as soon as people wake up, boom, you can't go back. Even though it's frightening to wake up and just say, whoa, holy crap, this is not what I thought I was living in. No, but this is the real world. I think the film The Matrix is very, very interesting, the first one, about these two different things, you know, an unplug
Yeah, it's a great analogy, but I think it doesn't give it, you know, it gives Neo all the power, but we're all Neo, you know. So yeah. I think so much about, like, whenever I feel people waking up, and, you know, I expose them to your work and other people's work, and it's kind of like, you know, down the rabbit hole. It's like, well, but once you're down the rabbit hole, it's actually your expansion, like that's where you're in your power. So I think that's what a lot of people miss, is just how powerful you become when you become knowledgeable, and how powerful you become when you understand that love is absolutely, like, we can do anything with that energy. It is so incredibly powerful. And that's certainly what I've been learning from my benevolent teachers, but I think it comes too at a cost, and I think that's a hard thing for me to swallow, is that there is a separation going on, and that we will be separated. There will be a time of a divorce, so to speak. And I think that's hard. That's a bit hard for us to understand.
I will experience this once I see it. Until then, I will not
what's happening now. You're creating it right now. That the separation is, these are the actors and these are not the actors. Mm. That's the separation.
True.
Yeah.
But I call the dark forces, I call them the black angels, you know, because I know, I see, the way I've chosen to see them, I don't know if it's true or not, but the way I choose to see them is that they take on a lot of bad karma to help us wake out of this game. So indirectly, I'm thanking these monsters as well. On a high level, now I'm talking on a really high level, I, you know, there's no way if I see somebody kick a dog or, you know, violently step on a mouse or hit a kid or something like that, I will interfere right away because not okay. At the same time, we're talking about on different levels. I just know what works for me.
Excuse me for 1 minute. Sorry, I think that's my 1 second. Hang on. Be able to talk about the conference just a little bit?
Go for it.
When does this air?
Oh, let me just pause. So, Susie, I know that there's this conference coming up in October, I believe it is. And I feel really honored and blessed that you invited me. So could you tell us a little bit about that and also how people can get in touch with you, if there's any way we can support you or in what you want to achieve and so on?
Sure. Well, I'm very honored and blessed that you're coming. It's your first time to New York, right?
It is indeed.
Wow, so exciting. So you'll be speaking at the Multiple Realities NY conference, and people can purchase tickets at multiplerealitiesny.com. And you can buy tickets to be there in person. We've got a very small crowd. It's only 250 people. The tickets are selling. So if you'd like to join us, then please grab a ticket straight away. And you can also join us on live stream. And those tickets are also going fast. So October 20th and 21st. And it's called Multiple Realities because we have different people, different world experts speaking about the different understanding of reality, from Ada Zavala, who's a Peruvian Wari indigenous lady from the Amazon, and she's an anthropologist and a curandera. We also have Grandmother Trico, who's a Native American spiritual teacher, speaking about the star people. We have also Michael Horn speaking about Billy Meyer and his UFO experiences. And we have Scott Onstott, who's also coming for the first time to New York, speaking about the golden ratio in sacred geometry, which is fascinating, also another view of reality. Penny Kelly's coming as well. She worked with Dr. Levengood, who's a quantum physicist, and she'll be speaking about the plasma fields, and also she'll be speaking about crop circles because she was working with Dr. Levengood doing experiments on all of the wheat sheaths that they had pulled out of the crop fields. Very interesting work. And of course, we have Ola Demigard speaking about the real reality of what's going on. And also Duncan Cameron, who is very famous for being the psychic sitting in the trip chair at Montauk Project. And very, very rare that Duncan comes forward and speaks in public. So this is going to be one of his first big talks in New York. He's going to be speaking about how he works with the energy field to let's say amplify or to boost reality. And it's very interesting. I had Preston Nichols and Duncan Cameron both did, they're both from the Montauk Project, and they both did experiments with me using their technology. One of them's actually on my YouTube channel. And they both said to me that I was a time traveler and that I don't come from this time zone and that I'm able to alter reality. So you find out some pretty interesting things about yourself. Yeah, who knows? I would like to alter people's reality by helping them learn more about multiple realities and exposing them to the brilliant work of people like Ola Demigard and all the other great people that are coming to our conference. So please expand your mind, find out more about what's going on from people that have been at it for a long, long, long time. If you're new to the field, it's going to be great to learn some information. And there's a few other people joining us, so have a look at the list of speakers. It's fantastic. MultipleRealitiesNY.com.
And what is the name of your YouTube channel?
I have a couple. Love Now Movement as three words. Love Now Movement as one word. and I also have some other spaces where you can connect with the channeling work that I do under Astria Channel and Susie Channel and, sort of divided all over the place with lots of different streams of information.
Listen, Susie, I really, really want to thank you for sharing these things and also for inviting us into your life and your experiences. I mean, you've had a very colorful life, I must say. So I'm really looking forward to meet you in October in New York. What is the name of the place where we're going to be?
Oh, it's a conference space. It's not important, the name. The important is the conference name, MultipleRealitiesNY.com.
Okay. Anyway, so thank you so much, and please don't be a stranger. Maybe we can meet another time here on this podcast. And until then, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for all the work you do too. Thank you, and I can't wait to see you. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Take care and see you soon.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize.